Can I get started? Okay, so we've been dealing with the question of Moshe Kibel Torah Misina Masara Li Yeshua. What does Kibel mean? What does Kibel mean? So Kibel officially just means that you've accepted it. It's an authoritative action. We saw that in fact one of the things pops up here is the question of the uniqueness, what's called the uniqueness of Mosaic prophecy. Moshe was Mekabel, and then he was Moser. And you have the shift in the first Mishnah, the word Kabbalah, which only means tradition or reception, it starts. Okay, so that's Ronnie Siegel's wife, but she's a woman in her own right. She's a very fine Tanakh teacher. In any event, so the rest of the first opening Mishnah is the rest of the opening Mishnah is in Avot, say so and so was received from so and so. The whole point of these Mishnah is to emphasize the authority, the authenticity, and the continuity of the Mesorah of Torah Shebal Peh, because when you have an oral tradition, I said this a few weeks ago, you're only as good as the guys that are passing it on. In
family. Link this to motion with the God himself.
Right, that's exactly the point. So that's what bump, 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 bump. So we saw already in the first year we were talking about the fact that Moshe, the reason why you have the shift from Kibel to Moser in the first mission and after that to Mekabel is very simple. It's because the first mission it comes to emphasize the uniqueness of Moshe Rabbeinu. So we saw that the other Nevi'im are not allowed to have an opinion in terms of Halacha. Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy is unique that way. And we saw a few other examples. We're going to continue with that, and I'm going to add kvetch, and nuance to it, and then we'll move on further on the Mishnah. What I gave you in front of you, the first source comes from the Rambam's introduction to Perek Chelet. Now, the Rambam did many amazing things in his life. One of the things he did, which was really unparalleled, was to liberate the Mishnah. Up until his time, I mean, from the time that the Talmud was redacted by Ravina and Ravashi, and then the Svaraim in the late 6th, early 6th century, to a significant degree, the Mishnah no longer existed as an independent object of study. It was swallowed up by the Gemara. I mean, you see the way that it's printed in our Gemaras. That's not the only proof, but you see that the Mishnah is sort of like scattered all over the place. In fact, a lot of places the Mishnayos in the Gemara are not even the units are not even the same as in the original Mishnah. What?
So
it's not Sanhedrin. It's Sanhedrin. Balul Bakol. Correct. Yeah. You find well.
That's because independent.
That we realize because right. The Gemara says Tanahatam Kai is going over there.
Right. Correct.
And it's like you look back and it's like wait that ain't over there.
Nachon. What?
Is it because if you realize that you didn't know what it's talking about.
Right, but the question is, what's Gemara? Is the Gemara an independent entity? Or is it the Perish on the Mishnah? In other words, where do you put the center of gravity? So the truth of the matter is, and in fact, among Ashkenazim, for example, in the 12th century, was very happy to say whereas the Gemara says in Kiddushin that you have to divide your time in thirds, a third Mikra, learn Tanakh, and they should learn Mishnah, and they should learn Gemara. Gemara, that means something slightly different. At that point, I don't want to go into it right now. The Maveda Tam quotes the Gemara in Sanhedrin that it's called Talmud Bavli. Why is it called the Babylonian Talmud? Because it's Balul Bakol. It has everything in it. So if you learn Gemara, you can learn. You'll say the mitzvah of learning Tanakh, and you'll say everything. Just learn Gemara. The Rambam. That goes back to that, correct.
Yeah.
The Rambam, on the other hand, when he quotes his halacha in Masechet Kiddushin, you should divide your time in third, Tanakh, Mishnah, and Gemara. Cites that Gemara explicitly, and he says, "No, you need to spend time learning Tanakh, and you learn to study Mishnah, and you have to study Gemara." The Rambam thinks that Gemara means analysis, and Mishnah means just knowing, absorbing facts. But the truth of the matter is that, in a very real sense, the Rambam also devoted himself, for all kinds of reasons, to liberating the Mishnah from the claws of the Gemara. In other words, he basically, for the first time, wrote a systematic perush on the entire Mishnah. In light of the Gemara, no question about it, but in a way, in order to be able to restore the Mishnah to its original role as the summary of the Torah Shebal Peh, as intended by Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, and you can just study it independently. The truth of the matter is, the Rambam liked the Mishnah because the Mishnah was you know, fairly unilateral. It makes decisions. It gives you majority, minority opinions. It's well organized. And in fact, there is a clear. It's clear that the Rambam, when he wrote the Mishnah Torah and he summarized the whole Torah Sheba'al Peh, he very much had the. He says so explicitly. He very much had the Mishnah of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi in mind when he did that as his model.
We're starting on Kohen when you read the very first Mishnah. You know, it doesn't make a lot of sense, really.
Right.
The Mishnah is not written in way of what we call Greek knowledge, you know, an introduction, a middle, an end.
Right, so the Rambam made order, but the first thing he did was to take the Mishnah and to make it to make available the small, really manageable units of learning, provide the supplementary information that's necessary in order to understand the Mishnah, and go weiter as an introduction to Torah Sheba'al Peh. In order to be able to do that, he also pegged to the Mishnah a number of different important introductions, so you'd be able to get at the material. So he wrote Hakdamah to the Mishnah in general. He wrote introduction, which describes the development of Torah Sheba'al Peh and the various component parts of Torah Sheba'al Peh. What's min haTorah and what's min derabbanan and what's halacha Moshe miSinai mean and what's a takana and what's a minhag and he's got a whole section there about the power of prophecy or lack thereof in this case and so on. Why is the Mishnah organized the way it is and what's an underlying rationale, why does one masechet come after another, a whole whatever.
Is everything he says a machloka, or does he hit everything right on the head and it's worth reading?
It's definitely worth reading. There may be people disagree with him because a lot of it's based on other makorot that other people disagree with, or they have different versions of it, but it's definitely worth learning, and no question. It's attached to the beginning of his commentary, so it is often mistakenly titled Hakdamat Rambam LeMasechet Seder Zra'im, the introduction of the Rambam to Zra'im, but he doesn't deal with Zra'im. It's not like he's trying to tell you what's Truman, what's Meiser, and what's this and what's that. It's really introduction to Torah Sheba'al Peh. Then he has another introduction to Perkei Avos, which is an introduction to ethical theory, and he's got an introduction to Taras, to all the laws of purities and impurities and Kalim and
Rishon. What's the one that's the introduction to Perkei Avos?
That's called Shmona Perkim. That's called Shmona Perkim.
I tried to learn that one.
It's very difficult. You really need to go through it very carefully.
It's like, I don't know, nothing went in my head.
Well, you need an introduction to Aristotelian. You need a certain amount of Aristotelian philosophy to be able to do it. In any event, sometimes the language is not the issue. Another one of the most very important introductions is called the Mavola Perak Chalik. As opposed to the other introductions, where the Rambam talks about large units of Mishnah, he comes to the tenth Perak in Sanhedrin. The tenth Perak in Sanhedrin starts off. Kol Yisrael Yeshlem Chelik L'Alam Haba. All Jews have a place in the world to come, and then the Mishnah says, and these are the ones who don't. Somebody who denies Torah Shemina Shemayim, and somebody says there's no Tchias Amei. All kinds of people who don't have a place in the world to come. The Rambam takes that, and the whole Perek is pretty much non halacha. It's pretty much agadita, and certainly the entire chapter in terms of the Gemara is all non-halakhic material, salagados and midrash and medrash and so on. The Rambam takes the occasion of Kol Yisrael Yeshlem Chelik Olam Haba to set forth a number of things. First of all, he says, what is the authority of, he has a long discussion of the authority of the interpretation of non-halakhic dicta and stories from Chazal. In other words, halakha is one thing. But what happens when you have stories that you don't know whether they should be interpreted in the, literally or not literally, and so on and so forth? That's one thing he deals with.
In other words, in terms of
do you take things literally? What's the mode of interpretation, not authority? Authority is I use that word because it's relevant to another passage from Rebbe Avraham ben Rambam that I don't want to go into right now. So we maybe sometime in the future. The most important thing the Rambam, though, does in this introduction, and he defines all things, what's Olam Haba, and what does Tchiyat HaMeitim mean, and what's going to be in Yimot HaMashiach, because these are all the issues that come up in this chapter. He also takes the occasion to do something which no one had ever done, and that is to formulate the dogmatics of Judaism. He argues that there are certain basic beliefs that you need to have.
Yigdal.
The Yigdal, actually Rambam might not have agreed with everything in Yigdal, but Yigdal's based on it. His first time in the history of Torah, somebody sat down and said, these are the basic beliefs that you must believe in court exactly the way I write them, or else you don't have a chelek v'olam haba. What? And the Rambam got it on the head for that. Like, who says? And they maybe this, maybe not this. The Ramban, for example, says that you won't go to hell if you don't believe in the coming of the Mashiach. It's a belief, but it's not a make or break belief. Others argue.
The Rambam says you might.
The Rambam says if you don't believe in Yibiyas Mashiach, then you have no chelak v'olam haba. Ramban says it's not a make or break issue. What?
Sounds like the Christians. If you don't believe in Christ, then
no. We believe beyond it. No, the Rambam. Why we have to depend on them for our validation?
No, I didn't say that.
The Christians say like this. The Christians say, if you don't accept their God as Messiah, functioning in a specific way, your soul is doomed to perdition. We say our belief in Mashiach goes way before. Okay, we believe that. So the Rambam would say that we believe as a matter of dogma, of a non-negotiable belief that, in fact, at the end of days, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu will send the son of Mashiach ben David, who will bring it back there to Israel as a whole. The Rambam's got a whole discussion. He's going to build a base of Mikdash. He'll bring everybody back from wherever, and so on and so forth. So according to the Rambam, they have no chelek v'olam haba.
There's not in the Chumash of the Navi, right?
So there's a lot of things not in the Chumash of the Navi. It's in the Navi. And there is a remez in the Chumash.
Mm-hmm. Is the attempt to write it down a response to the worlds which they're living in?
So that's a good question. There are actually two lines of explanation which don't contradict each other. So number one, the idea that you have to formulate the beliefs may very well have been, a response to contemporary concerns. We'll see in a minute that in terms of one or two of these, it definitely had a contemporary edge to it. However, there's an even better reason for why the Rambam did this. As I said later, people said that there were 12, there were 13, there were Yosef Albo and the Sefer Karim said there's three. It's all over the place. Mm-hmm. The best explanation as to why I think was provided by really one of the leading historians of Jewish philosophy alive today, a man named Professor Arthur Hyman, who was a YU for Columbia, and he was a YU for many years. He was the senior student, aside from my teacher Professor Tversky, of the late Professor Harry Wolfson. The Rambam says that people don't get into Olam Haba unless they actualize their intellect to a certain degree. It's not enough to believe. You have to have accurate Jewish philosophical knowledge in order for that part of your neshama, which is going to survive, because not all parts of the neshama survive, only the intellect, according to the Rambam. For that part of the neshama to survive, you have to have the right information. You have to have the right knowledge.
He says you have to know God, not to know.
Right, exactly. So the question is, to what degree? Not everybody is philosophically inclined to the same degree. So that's what you need to actualize your intellect in order to make it to Olam Haba. Then the Rambam comes to a Mishnah, and the Mishnah says explicitly, Kol Yisrael Yeshem Chaylik Olam Haba. All Jews are a priori guaranteed a place in the world to come. So the Rambam this is the ultimate faith and reason moment, or revelation and reason moment, because the revelation says everybody's got a guaranteed seat, and the Rambam, based on his philosophical consideration, said no, unless you have all this information, unless you have this philosophical knowledge, these beliefs, you're not going to get in. So how do you solve it? So the Mishnah forces the Rambam to say, how, according to my system, can a person make it? It's Olam Haba. So he provides, he says, if you believe in these 13 things and you know what they're about and you understand them, then you'll get it. You won't be in the orchestra. You won't be in the front part of the orchestra. You'll probably be way up in the second balcony, but at least you make it. No, at least you make it into the concert. You think I'm kidding. The Rambam, I don't think it's here, I think it's upstairs. There's a famous parable the Rambam has in the 51st chapter of the third section of the Mor Nevuchim, yeah. In which he just what? No, it's okay. Oh, do you have the Mor Nevuchim? Oh, you have the Chabad Erech there.
Yeah.
Oh, so give me the Mor Nevuchim.
I was wondering the response to the Karaite.
No, I don't think the Karaite issues. Oh, okay. No, I have.
Was that a big threat?
The Karaites were a very big threat, and the Rambam. A lot of things in the Rambam actually were based on fighting the Karaites. Marty Luchin. Okay, Yofi, this is perfect.
So things like Olam Haba.
No. That was the issue. The issues with the Rambam were other things, with carrots were other things. Everybody believes in Olam Haba. Anybody, all monotheistic faiths believe in Olam Haba. That's not. That's something we gave everybody else. Okay, so the Rambam writes. This is chapter 51. Thank you very much for this. Okay, so the Rambam says as follows. He says, "Vani poteach hadvarim bazeh haperek b'mashal she'esayu lecha." I'm going to describe the answer by means of a parable. Va'omar. Also says as follows: "Ki amelech uvehechalo." The king is in his palace. Vanashav kulam, all of his people, all of his retainers. Ktsatam anshei medina v'ktsatam michutz lamedina. Some are inside the country, and some are outside the country. Okay. Elu asher bamdina, some of them are among those who were still in the country, mehem misha achorav el beit hamelech umegamat panav b'derech acheret. Some people have their back to the palace and they're walking out. Umehem misha rotze lalechet el beit hamelech, some actually have grown in the right direction, they want to go to the palace, umegamato elav, and they're going the right way, umevakesh levaker beichalov elamod lefanav, and they really want to see the king and visit him, ela sha'ad ayom lo ra'a pnei chumat habayit klal. But they have never gotten, until this point, they've never gotten anywhere near the outside wall of the house. Among those who have made it to the palace, to the house, and there were those who have made it to the palace, but they're walking around. They haven't made it inside yet. They're still making a kafis around the palace. They're looking for the gate. Some made it through the gate. And they're in the outer hallway. Some have actually gone through the antechamber. They're in the palace. They're in the house. And they make it into the king's overall area, and that's the house of the king. But just because he's in the palace, that means he's going to see the king. He could be kept in the waiting room. Okay? Oh, yidaberimo, we'll talk to him. Avalachar, hagiyol, toch habayit, iefsharlo, biltiltisha, ishtadil, ishtadlut acherit. But once he gets in, he's gonna double up his efforts to try to get in. Va'az yamodaf ne'amelech, at that point, he'll get to stand before the king, vi'ireu mayrachok, and he'll see him either from close up, or from far away, or from close up. Or, alternatively, yishmadvar amelech, he'll hear what the king has to say, or yidaberimo. He might even get close up. So now what is this whole story? He says, "If you haven't figured out the parable, I'll tell you what it means." So I'll tell you what I mean. Omnam, he says, "Asherhem michutz la medina." Those who are really never made it even into the kingdom, they're like way out. Hem kol an ish mibnei adam she'en lo emunat dat. Those are all people that don't have a religious faith. Lo miderech ha'iyun, they didn't arrive at it philosophically, midorah the Kabbalah, or they were never revealed faith. Like the Turks who are up in the north, and the blacks in the south, and people live in different countries. Why? Because these are people who are not they're animists, they're pagans, they're idolaters. You know, so they're out of the game totally. By the way, I would say this is also just. By the way, this is the cutting issue in terms of Islam too. Those people don't have a religion, don't have a right to live according to Islam. So if they go in and conquer, like when they conquered India, they didn't think that the Hindu religion was a religion. They still, no, I'm not going into that right now.
We don't say people don't have a right to live. Do
we don't know. People who come to live in Israel have got to be monotheists. No, that's something else. That's if they go and worship idols. That's if Jews go and worship idols, then you wipe the city out.
But it
never happened anyway. No, but the Muslims our concern is the Eretz Israel. We're not supposed to allow avodah zarah in Eretz Israel. And you're not allowed to enfranchise Gentiles who are not who don't accept the seven mitzvahs.
Isn't the Mormon rather sat on the stone heap of the same son of the Yernadaka? It's not so PC, so they didn't put it in the mainstream newspapers.
I don't remember that. In any case, the Muslims, because they think the whole world is their oyster, they have to conquer the world as part of their religion, and that's what jihad means. When they go in, they have to deal with the non-Muslim population. So the Sharia law is that when they go in, They say, who has a religion? Who does have religion? Anybody who has a belief in one God, who lives, exists outside of history and gave a revelation to man, meaning Jews, Christians, or Mazdeans, meaning Zoroastrian Persians, or from Persia originally, they have a right to live under, you know, legitimate circumstances. We have to go into that right now. Anybody else, convert or die. That's the deal. That's the convert or die. And so therefore, the dirty little secret of world history is the fact that there's a reason why the Hindus hate the Muslims. Because they were slaughtering them for centuries until they finally sort of like, gave up sort of. But it's still, it's not for nothing when there were riots in India, the first thing the Hindus go after is the mosques. Because this is like an unstated something. In fact, a friend of mine told me that he was at a meeting, and that's why, by the way, they did the partition. That's why the British partitioned India.
Bangladesh
and Pakistan. Originally, it was East Pakistan and West Pakistan. But that's because it wasn't possible. In fact, a friend of mine told me that he was at a meeting in England I think it was through the European Union or the UN, I'm not sure, I don't remember which now, in which they were discussing the question of the right of so-called right of return, and they're one of the, I guess, UN representatives was an Indian, and he said, I don't understand. Today, if a Pakistani Muslim comes and tries to resettle in India or buy back or get back his property, so he is liable to the death penalty. So, you know, I don't understand where this right of return thing. I'm not trying to make a point in terms of the Palestinians. My point is that this animosity runs deep, and it's based on a consideration similar to what the Rambam talks about. The fact the Rambam's talking about philosophically, they have no chelik lo mahaba, is very nice. But the point is, the distinction between a person who has religion and doesn't have religion is precisely what the Muslims want.
When he writes, is he writing from sort of a Jewish source orientation? Or living in an Islamic environment?
No, he's coming straight. He's coming
something from Islam itself.
No, I don't think so. I think here he's really coming through on. It can easily grow out of philosophical perspective. If the only way you're going to get to truth is by coming to the belief in one God, if you're an animist, so you're not in the story. I mean, it's that simple. If you don't subscribe to the whole business, your mind is never going to get perfected, and you're never going to go anywhere. You don't need to go. You don't need to go that far. Okay. Anyway, so then he goes on and says as follows: Vasher. Okay. Now, what about the people that are in the? What about the people that are in the country? Elishachorehem el Beit Hamelech. People that are walking out. Hem balei emunah v'iyun. These are people who of belief or of philosophical bent or both. Ela sha'alu bi'adam de'ot bilti amitiyot. Except that they arrived at untrue conclusions about faith issues or religious issues. Im matot mita'ut gadol shenafal bi'adam be'itiyunam o shekiblu mimi shehitam. Whether they came to the mistakes on their own or somebody misled them. V'hem la'olam mipnei ha'deot ha'hem. You make one wrong turn, you just keep going out. So whether you're a sectarian or whether you're a heretic or whether you come up with an emunah which is incorrect or a philosophical conclusion which is incorrect, unless somebody's going to correct you, you started okay, but you ended up walking out.
So that's very intellectual. I mean, if you were
the rabbi was very intellectual.
I mean, if you're a great person in terms of your actions.
Correct.
If you have the wrong distress in mind in all these cases, you're out.
Right. But if you have, but the Rambam will say you cannot have the right hashkafas unless you have the right modes of behavior. The two go together. The Elu, okay, he says, and these are the worst because they're actually dangerous. And then he goes, Vaharotzim lavo el Beit HaMelech, and those who want to come to the house of the king, Uli Kanesetzlo el Shalo Ra'u Beit HaMelech Klal, these people that they're still walking, but they haven't gotten to the king's house yet. Heim Hamon Anshei HaTorah, those are most of the religious Jews. Ritzoni Lomar, I mean to say, Amei Haaretz Oskim BaMitzvot. People that are not particularly learned, but they're observant. Okay, and then so they're in the ball game, but they don't get to see the king's palace. They're sort of like someplace in the second. You have a phone call.
No.
All right. And then he says, Vamigima beta habayat holchim misvivo, and those that make it to the palace but never really get in, hema talmudim. Those are the rabbis, the Talmidei Chachamim, asher ma'aminim deot amitiyot. They have the right ideas, mitzad kabbalah, but they know them by way of tradition. ולומדים מעשי העבודות ולא הרגילו בעיון שורשי התורה ולא חקרו כלל לאמת נכון אמונה. They have the right ideas, they have the right beliefs, they know what's going on, but they don't know them from a philosophical point of view, they can't prove them, they don't know the underpinnings, but they know they have them by way of tradition. And then he says those who go into the palace, that depends on what your level of whatever is, and that's how close you get to the king.
And the top is the intellectual.
Is the intellectual king. Okay, now. And the one who really gets to see, by definition, we'll see in a minute, is Moshe Rabbeinu. I mean, he's the one that gets closest, gets the absolute closest. Now, the Rambam, according to Dr. Hyman, I think he's right, that when the Rambam has this take on how the soul gets actualized, he comes to this Mishnah in Sanhedrin. Everybody's in. So if everybody's in, so how does that work? So I will now provide you with the base, with the major true knowledge that'll allow you at least certainly to be in the country. The truth of the matter is the way he describes. I never noticed this before. The way he describes the Rabbanim and Talmidei Chachamim. He's actually giving, sort of jump starting the average Joe, the average Balabas, from somewhere in the countryside to the palace, because the guys in the countryside, they're doing the right thing, but they don't know anything. Blank slate. So it seems. Whereas Talmidei Chachamim, they have the right information, they just don't have it from on a strong philosophical basis. So therefore, the Rambam is basically giving you the 13 Ikarim, he's just saying, here, I'm pushing you forward. You know, the average Joe now has a better shot, not just at a place in Olam Haba, but a better place in Olam Haba than he might otherwise have, according to this, at least according to this version of the story. So coming up with these 13 dogmas is certainly something that grows out of the Rambam's own dynamic of trying to meld a philosophy together with Torah. On the other hand, there are places where it is clear that the Rambam takes something and runs with it. And so I'm gonna mention two part sides of this. Part of it we mentioned it before, so I'm not gonna in the first year, so I'm not gonna go into it in depth now. The Rambam devotes no less than three of the Ikarim, of the principles, to the question of the uniqueness and the eternality of Torah. I have here it's 7, 8, and 9. 7 is the uniqueness of Moses' prophecy. Lakam b'Yisrael, kemoshe, okay? And then you have, number 8 is the Torah comes from heaven. Hayesod HaShmini, Utara Min HaShamayim. No, it's number 1, but it's in the text. Okay, and then the last one, Yesod HaShmini, HaBitul, that the Torah can't be mitbatel. Okay. The longest discussion is devoted to the Nevuah of Moshe Rabbeinu. That nobody can be like Moshe Rabbeinu, and he writes on and on and on about what Moshe Rabbeinu is different than all the other Nevi'im, and he can't be changed, and this and that, and then on and on and on and on and on and on. Why devote three Ikarim to the same thing? If Moshe Rabbeinu's Nevuah is unique, so by definition, the Torah he gave is can't be added to, it comes from heaven, and it can't be changed, and it can't be annulled.
He wants to make a very strong foundation.
That's number one. But happens to be that in this case, the Rambam has a polemical axe, because what was the argument of the Muslims? That Moses' prophecy was annulled in a process called Nasch, and that the ultimate revelation, which took the place of all of them, was Muhammad.
The Christians also.
The Christians argue the same way, exactly.
Except
the difference is that the Christians claim that they were the real Israel, that they are the real Jews, and that they have the right shot in the Torah. And they claim that Christianity basically claims that it's the real Judaism, okay? And that in the Christians are the verus Israel, as they say in Latin, that they're the real Israel. The Muslims say no. Stage one, Jews, Judaism, very nice, boom, finished. Stage two is Christianity, Jesus, very nice, finished. Now we come to Islam. That's the whole ball game. You want to see where the Rambam makes very, very clear. So where it makes it very clear that it's all based on Moshe Rabbeinu and nobody else afterwards. The emphasis on Moshe Rabbeinu and nobody else, nobody from Moshe Rabbeinu and nobody else. You see from actually it comes out even more beautifully in the Mishnah Torah. The Rambam comes back to define the uniqueness of Moshe Rabbeinu three different times. Now the Rambam was a guy who actually did mince words. In other words, if he could say something in three words, he wouldn't say it in four. And he writes about how he's proud of how styptic he writes and how carefully he writes. And he writes over. In fact, I remember as many years ago, it was about 30, I'll tell you how many years ago, it was almost 40 years ago. Wow. Almost 40 years ago. No, can't be. No. Almost 30 years ago, 27 years ago, I was sitting in the library in the library of JTS in working on my doctorate, and they were marking the 800th anniversary of the publication of the Mishneh Torah, and in the back of the rare book room, the old reading room, they had a case with all kinds of fragments and manuscripts of the Mishneh Torah that they had put out. And there was a beautiful illuminated manuscript and so on, but one in the corner was a Geniza fragment from the Rambam Hilchos Shechinim, I think it is. And you see, from the Rambam's old notebook that was in the Geniza. And you see where the Rambam, there's no whiteout. So the Rambam crosses out and writes over and crosses out and writes over. And you see the laboratory. This is, you know, when he says, I'm very, very careful about what I write, and I don't write more than I have to, and I don't write less than I have to, you see it exactly in this little fragment, in this little papyrus, in a paper fragment. In any event, so the Rambam comes back to this issue of Moshe Rabbeinu at least three times in the introduction to the Mishnah. He does it again in the Mishnah Torah, and he does it here. So something's got him by the throat over here.
Three separate books,
right? But he does it. He's not a repeat himself. Why?
The same target audience. So people.
Yeah, ostensibly, yeah. Or even if not, why does every single time he's got an opportunity, he comes back to this? Mm-hmm. The answer is that this was a real issue. So if you take a look, but the way he writes it in the Mishnah Torah is clearly makes the point. It says the Rambam in the ninth chapter of Yesod HaTorah, where he talks about prophecy. He says, "Davar barur mufarash baTorah." It is obvious and explicit in the Torah. Shehim mitzvah omedet laolam ulo me'alamim. That the Torah stands is forever. Eila lo shinui velo gira'on. You know, it has no change, suffers no change or no deficiency. Velo tosefet. You can't add to it. Shenemar et kol. And he quotes the pasuk in Devarim. Es kol davar shera nochi mitzvetchem oto tishmim lasot lo tosif alav velo tigrami menu. Okay. Venema lo b'shamayimi. Okay, and it says the Torah is no longer in heaven. Halamarata. From this we learn she'ein navi rashai lechadesh davar me'ata, that the prophet is no longer allowed to innovate anything in the Torah. That's something we saw, but it was based on a different pasuk. Generally, the pasuk that the Gemara quotes is elu hamitzvot at the end of Bamidbar. Says these are all the mitzvahs. The Gemara says you learn from this she'ein navi rashai lechadesh davar me'ata, that no navi is allowed to, by virtue of being a prophet, to say I'm going to add to the Torah. The Rambam doesn't use that pasuk here. The Rambam uses lo b'shamayim, that there is no longer any further role for divine intervention in the halachic process. It's a much stronger way of making the argument, and it certainly has polemical implications.
But once you have the Gemara, the lo b'shamayim,
that's about something else. That's
then,
what.
Then we could,
no, we but want. Don't you understand that that's where it's different, because there you're talking about God just saying you have the Torah. I'm not intervening in terms of Paskin and Shilas.
So what's with the bat codes?
Oh, that's a good question. The question is,
and that bat code they ignore?
What about the bat code with regard to Halachot Shama, Beis Hillel and Shammai?
Does the bat
call
mean like the word on the street?
No, bat call means a voice that comes out of heaven. Most bat calls, we'll get to it later on. Not today, but most bat calls are not normative. In other words, not in the sense of they're not, you don't listen to them. In the sense they're not halachic. They tell you stuff. A bat kol tells all kinds of stuff. A bat kol goes out, Rabbi Akiva goes to heaven. A bat kol comes and says, somebody here is worthy of being a Navi, but it's his generation isn't worthy. A bat kol comes out and says, God is crying over the base of Mikdash. All kinds of bat kol. But Hillel and Shammai, that's already a story. So that, yeah, we have to look at.
We don't have bat kols anymore because Everybody would say it's a hidden speaker.
Either that, or we say.
How do you know the Barco? Maybe it's some.
I've always worried what would happen if they gave SSRIs to Yirmiyahu, and if we would probably put all of our prophets in the insane asylum. I mean, I don't know. It's like very interesting. Having in my years as a cop, I mean, you know, we say all these people, these holy people, who were talking to themselves. Now we say that they're on hands-free units on their phones,
or Bluetooth. Well, aren't there Mekubalim today who say things to people which the people themselves are very shocked that they know how to say something.
Right. No, there are certainly, so according to Alfie Kabbalah, there are these extra dimensions of understanding stuff. Yeah, sure.
We believe that that's...
People who are not, people who are litvaks are just generally not inclined to such things. People who are chassidim tendently aren't inclined to it. Misnagdim generally are allergic to things like that. I don't know. I mean, okay. In any event, the...
isn't it true that, like, there are certain horat shah that they can go against Allah?
That's something else.
Like,
that's something else. No. But it's interesting. Think of the implication. What was the rule over there? The rule over there. What's the Gemara say? That yesh koach biyad chachamim lakar davar min haTorah bekumasei ke Eliyahu behar haKarmel. It's not a question of Eliyahu is not perceived as functioning as a navi. He's perceived as functioning as he's presented as being functioning as the Gadol HaDor of his generation. The Rambam makes this distinction. All of the people in the beginning of the Mishnah Torah, the Rambam goes up and forth. We talked about this in the first year. Goes up and back, tracing the generation after generation of Torah Shebal Peh from Moshe Rabbeinu down to Ravina and Ravashi at the end of the time of the Gemara. He does it three times. He starts from Moshe Rabbeinu. He goes back. Goes down to Ravashi. Then he lists all of the generations. Tells you how many generations. I don't remember how many are at the moment. And then he goes back. Ravashi all the way to Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay? Most of the people in the first half of those lists are all Nevi'im, but they're not functioning as Nevi'im. They're functioning as Chachamim.
They say they didn't do it through Nevi'im.
They did it through their heads.
Via the Torah.
Yeah, exactly. For example,
it's built in the Torah that, like, exception.
For example, I'll give you an example. No, that you can be compartmentalized.
The Tanakh stories always see the functioning as Nevi'im. We never see the Paschim.
That's true. Torah Shebichsav does not give you that angle of their activity. However, this doesn't mean that they weren't shofet at the Amin functioning as Chachmei Masorah. Why? The Tanakh can tell you a lot of things. It's a lot of material. A lot of information is not there. We have tons of stuff we don't know. Whatever the Navi decided, we have to know. That's what we should know. But it's also true in that story, the nisim, the miracles he does, that might be b'koach hanavuah. But he goes and makes. It doesn't say God says go. I think so. Was it? Does God say go make him his bach and go meet Achav? According to Gemara, he just went and passed him the shiloh, and that's it. He knew that the valderach hanavuah that there was going to fire was going to come from heaven. All that stuff, that's something else. Okay, or what was the point of contention halachically? The point of contention halachically was the fact that it was a base of mikdash, and you're not allowed to have outside mizbeach, and that was had to be paskin. The rest of it, the water, the this, the that, the other thing, that's all derech hamenavuah. That's irrelevant. It's not relevant to our issues. People can have more than one expertise.
Another thing is, it's not really so much a korban to Hashem.
It
was a contest.
It was both.
I'm saying the point of it wasn't really that we're worshiping to Hashem.
No, it's actually not true. That's not true. No. This was a korban. The vehicle was a korban because, by definition, the acceptance of the korban is the sign of worship of God and of divine approval. And what was the result of the people?
They killed all the Nevi'im.
You never say with the blood and the fire. He shakes it, cuts it up, and then God sends the fire down himself.
All right, so he didn't keep ready. He did ostensibly. I don't remember what Chazal said.
It's
clearly a mizbeach because he says he goes and he restores the mizbeach Hashem Haharus, and there were 12 stones. Kimispar Shitei Yisrael. It's clear that that's what he's doing. He's not doing the avoda precisely the way that ostensibly. I don't know. I don't remember what the matter says, but ostensibly based on the pshat, he's not doing exactly. With the base of Mikdash, okay, but it's clearly a korban. And by the way, what is this Yichus Eliyahu? It's Cohen. So that's the reason, by the way, that the Arabs. One of the explanations why is there a Muslim cemetery on the east wall of the Harabai? Because they got confused because they knew that they thought that they'd stop the Mashiach that way.
Right.
But because they thought Mashiach was a Kohen. But Eliyahu is a Kohen. Mashiach is a normal guy. I mean, he's got a lot of yichus, but he's a normal guy. And the Kohen, if he has to, can, you know, I'm sure there'll be, I should sort of float in, it won't be a problem. Although floating in is not helpful, the guy in the bag, the guy in the bag on the jet, that's true.
He's on the white donkey.
Is
there a lot of basis for that bag?
Oh yeah, there's a long discussion. I have a 30 page article.
Picture in his bedroom.
Of a Kohen who flew. What happens is a guy who's a Kohen who flew on El Al over the Cholon cemetery, and since Tuma goes up straight up, so the argument of Kohen can't go over cemetery even in the air. So he was
totally
in a sealed bag, and that prevent that
but
stops
the
Tuma. Oh, so that's the question. So the big one, this guy. I'm telling you, there's a 35. I think it's 35. There's a 35. No, it is an issue. There was a 35 page. Article that was written by a friend of mine from Yeshiva yet, but a very fine Talmud Chacham who's an expert in these things, who is one of the two people in the world that I call when I have issues like that in research, Rabbi Danny Wolf from Haaretzion, and he wrote this 35 page.
I think you like Wolfson.
No, his yichus is a married girl from Boston. But
he's Talmud bad anyway. So.
No. The Isser is to come in contact with Tumah. It's not to be Talmud.
No, we are all Talmud bad anyway.
Doesn't matter. A Kohen is usher to be to come in contact. No,
he can't walk into the cemetery. But if it happens to fly over,
oh, so that's the question. Listen, there are plenty of studied. No, there are plenty. That's the whole point of this article. No. Is he points out that there are all kinds of angles to try to listen. First of all, is if the plane is sealed. If the plane is sealed, is it Mekabel Tuma so that it might actually, or is it not Mekabel Tuma? It's not Mekabel Tuma, so it can prevent the Tuma from coming. Or if it is Mekabel Tuma, maybe there are all kinds of other considerations. There are tons of considerations and ways to be able to say this way or that way. But the point was, what was the point? The point is, I guess apropos to the if Eliyahu sort of floats in over the cemetery,
the bag actually might do something.
No, because the bag is made out of plastic. Plastic is not Mekabel Tuma. Something which is not Mekabel Tuma blocks Tuma. It's not a cloth. The material itself is not Mekabel Tuma. Only certain materials are Mekabel Tuma. Cloth is Mekabel Tuma, only if it's made in a certain way. I mean, for example, if it's woven, you make things out of metal is like the worst. That's like electricity, right? The Mekabel Tuma is like the worst way. Anything usually right? Wool. I mean, those are Mekabel Tuma, but plastic is by definition not Mekabel Tuma. Interestingly, by the way, interesting question with regard to a question of wearing synthetic clothes. Are they chayv and tzitzis? No chayv business. Is it a beged?
No,
it's a long discussion. Actually, a very important and interesting book of tshuvas that was written by a guy from Rafat, actually, Rabbi Dr. Aviad Stallman, who's the head of the curator at the National Library. He's a big Talmud Chacham. He was for years a Rav on the Zayit and elsewhere, and he wrote a Sefer of Tshuvas, a review of which I've been slaving over for a long time. I'm almost finished with it. I'm trying to do it right. It's a wonderful Sefer, and I want to do it properly. The book is called Pele Yoetz, and the first siman discusses the question of whether, what about a book, a beged made out of synthetic materials? Is it called a beged? So these things have all kinds of ramifications. In any event, so let's go back to the Rambam. So Rambam says that we know the Torah is eternal and so on and so forth, and after Moshe Rabbeinu, after the Torah, is no additions, no detractions, no nothing, no prophet can have anything to do with the Torah. And then the Rambam, this is what I wrote in, put in bold.
It sounds like you can't add to the Torah, yet we always figure out ways of adding.
Adding means no.
Not from the Torah.
That's exactly right.
Sounds like a little bit of a trick.
No, because it says, Asur Mishmeret Mishmarti, you have an explicit mandate in the Torah, two places actually, explicit mandate in the Torah for Chazal to legislate. One is Ushmartem is Mishmarti, Asum Mishmeret Lishmarti, the way the Chazal say. In other words, you are allowed to take preventative measures and supplementary measures to protect the core of the Torah, and those and the other one is Lotasur, the way the Chazal say you have to do. What? That's what we're going to get to at the end of this Mishnah, but that's exactly the point. It's a siyag. As long as you don't say it's Min HaTorah, you're okay. But the truth of the matter is that you can't. There's a logic to this. People can't function with with too many fine distinctions. You gotta know it's mutter or it's usser. If you start making chachmalogim, that's exactly the example. Why? Because but why is that? Why is that? Because what happens is that that is the end of a long period, long stage, a long process of development, in which you had to be concerned about this and about that and about the other thing and all kinds of permutations. Basically, this minig, which apparently developed among the women, Benos Yisrael Chashmiro Latzman, what they did was they took the worst case scenario and they went with it. So there's no chokhmas. You always know that every time something happens, this is what it is. You wait 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, whatever it is, depending on the different stages of development. 7 days, the kiyum, goodbye. You don't have to worry about what time of month it is. Is it the first 7 days or the last 11 days? And it's so complicated, right, that you... So Rambam already says this. There's a process in law called leveling, in which you cut. You know, this is what's mutter, this is what's also goodbye. Because otherwise you can't. We're going to start on Shabbos. Okay, what was my kavana? Did I do it this way? Did I do it that way? Is it this? Is it that? Is it the other? I mean, it's far too impossible. It's really impossible.
So we have to say that Ethiopian Jews or these other factions are simply pre these discussions, because obviously it's not them from.
It depends on what stage of the ballgame. It's interesting, there's a big debate going on now. A very good friend of mine, who teaches at Bar Ilan, is a member of Beit Hillel. Also, his name is Rabbi Sharon Shalom. And he is he's Ethiopian, a graduate of Gush Av Harzion, and he wrote a book in which he compares the received traditions of the Ethiopians to the Din Shulchan Aruch, and he tries to make some kind of a compromise to protect the integrity of Ethiopian religious practices, but bring them as much as possible in line with.
The difference implies that everything is not from the original source. That's my point.
No, because what happens? I don't know Ethiopian halacha. I don't know Ethiopian halacha that well. Okay, if it's a matter of drabbanans that they fell off of, so you have to deal with that. But if it's a question of halacha, something like Sinai and all kinds of things that they just weren't aware of,
right,
then you have to bring them into line.
I wouldn't say drabbanans are originally really from Moshe Rabbeinu.
Not all the rabbanans. Some yes, some no. Some, look, we have to make a distinction between halacha and Moshe Sinai. And whatever. So, for example, we have, I don't know. Say the Ethiopians, let's make this up. I mean, I have no idea. Say the Ethiopians ended up moving. They moved out. I don't know. They moved out. I don't know. They moved out. No. Say they moved out before that. Say they moved out in the middle of the time of the Talmud. So everything that happened after that stage, they don't know. Now the truth of the matter is, their tradition has it that they left with their Sheva done, and they left before the first Korban, before the Korban Abayis,
right.
So they don't know about Purim. Their Purim is a sad day because they didn't know that all the Jews were saved. They just knew about, they don't have the Book of Esther, so they just know that there was a Gezerah and that all Jews were supposed to die, and they thought all the Jews died, so that's a fast day by them. Okay,
the day before by us.
That's very late. That's very late. That's already the Middle Ages. Chazal don't know anything about Tanis Esther. Okay, Beseder. So we will. And so let me just finish the last five lines, and then we'll break for we'll break. Lefichach im yamod ish mi be. The Rambam says lefichach im yamod ish bein mina umot bein mi Israel. Whether he arises from among the nations or from among the Jews. Why do I care about a bit among the nations? And he works a wonder. And he says that God sent him lahosif mitzvah, to add a mitzvah, or to grow a mitzvah, to take apart a mitzvah, or to faresh b'mitzvah, mitzvah b'mitzvot, perush shalosh shamano mimoshe, an inauthentic interpretation of the mitzvah which we didn't hear from Moshe. Oshe amar sheotana mitzvot shenitztavu behen Yisrael enan la'olam ul'dorei dorot. Or he comes and says they're not forever. Okay, Ella mitzvot lefi zman hayu, which is the Muslim argument. Hareze navi sheker. That, by definition, is a navi sheker. He could be the, you know, whatever. Shahare bala hakrish nevuaso shel Moshe, because he came to deny the eternality of the prophecy of Moses. Kemosha, here's the catcher. Kemosha amar haachron b'hem. He brings in the pasuk at the end of Malachi, the last navi. Towards the end of the last chapter, in Navi says, "Zichru Taras Moshe Avdi Asher Tzivisi Oto B'Choreiv Hakol Yisrael Chukim Mishpatim." If the last Navi comes to say that this is what that the point of departure and the end point is always Taras Moshe, that tells you that no Navi is ever allowed to say anything or to bekach nevuah to deny Moshe. That's a specifically anti-Muslim point. Okay. However, at the same time, as we'll see, there are other considerations why you need to protect Moshe Rabbeinu's nevuah and to say nothing Moshe Rabbeinu does changes. But that we'll have to see next time.